Thank you, Roger Badish. Good morning, everybody. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. We're live from the Allstate Showcase Studio here in the historic Tribune Tower building on the Magnificent Mile. And it's a balmy like 40 degrees outside right now, isn't it, Rog?
Yeah, it's pretty close, about 38, 39.
It's gorgeous out there, quite honestly, with what we dealt with lately. Mm-hmm. Joining us on the phone right now is a man who lived in conditions. I checked today, and I believe the high at the South Pole today was going to be negative like 22, 23. I believe this is the good time of year when it's like
warm,
that.
It's the
warm season right down there. Well, negative 22, 23. Dr. John Bird is the co-author of the book One Day, One Night, Portraits of the South Pole. He joins us on the phone right now. Hey, John, how are you doing? Let's see if I did that wrong. John, are you there?
Yeah, hi, Matt.
Hey, how are you, sir?
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me on the show.
Oh, thanks very much for jumping on the phone. I appreciate it. I have to tell you, I have not gotten nearly as far as I'd like in the book. I'm only 75 pages in, but I love this book, and I love the account. When I have to admit, John, I got the pitch for it, and I emailed the person. You emailed me right back, had a book sent, and I thought, boy, this is going to be kind of tough to get through. But you and your wife, Jennifer, wrote alternating chapters and wrote it in a way that us non-scientists could easily go along with it and get into it. And quite honestly, you guys, I don't know if you were both writers before this book, but really sucked me into life at the South Pole and the demands of it and the rigors of it. And frankly, John, I'm going to tell you, looking back, I assumed, well, I'll talk to the scientist, not the musician. But Jennifer is the one that's really got me sucked into this book, not you so far yet. But I'm only 74 pages in. You just got there.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's a good way to have both perspectives. She focused mainly on the aspects of life and the human condition.
Yeah.
And I tend to focus more on the science. But either way, it's a unique environment. And it's, of course, a lot colder than Chicago this morning.
Yes, it is.
Enjoying the warm weather there right now.
Well, it is nice right now, and we've had a pretty rough winter as far as cold. We haven't gotten much snow, but we had a string of, I think, close to 30 days where it didn't get above freezing, and some really, really cold and wind chilly days, but nothing compared to life at the South Pole, that's for sure. Let me give the background real quick on the story and then have you start taking it away. You're a scientist. You were living, I believe, with your wife up in Toronto. A friend of yours or somebody you had worked with, a colleague, had a experiment or things they were going to work on at the South Pole for a year. They needed help. So they contacted you. You said, I'd love to, but only if my wife can go too. So she was able, and it's very interesting read that, you know, she had to be an American. She wasn't an American. She's Canadian, but there's these loopholes where if you have some, you know, and her father had lived in America for a long enough time that she could apply for citizenship, you get it all worked out. And she gets hired as a dishwasher, and you're going to go down and be an assistant on this experiment. And and it's fascinating to read about. I haven't gotten into much of the science yet, but just her first, because she had to go without you. Or I guess her job just started earlier. So she's there for a few weeks before you get down there, and she's washing dishes a lot at 12,000 feet altitude, which is tough to adjust to. What was being married and committing to going to the South Pole for you? You both must have a wonderful spirit of adventure, but how difficult was that to come to that decision to pull that off?
Well, it's something I always wanted to do anyway. I was headed to Mars, and of course, there's no funding for that these days, but the South Pole is the next best thing, and it all started at the University of Illinois, just down there in Urbana, south of Chicago, where they were organizing the experiments down there to study the atmosphere at the South Pole. And so for me, it was the greatest opportunity ever. But for Jennifer, she didn't really have much time to think about it, so we just started getting ready, and then in the meantime, she thought about it and decided it would be worth the challenge. But you're right, initially there's a bit of an adjustment with the pressure, because you're sitting on 2 miles thickness of ice, so you're up at 12,000 feet elevation, so of course the air is relatively thin, so there is a bit of adaptation, like trying to acclimatize on a mountain.
So that's why you're at 12,000 feet, because it's that deep of ice that you're living on?
That's right, because the so-called diamond dust, these little ice crystals, continuously fall onto the surface, and they just build up year after year. And now the Antarctica is covered with these ice sheets.
That's amazing. Now, this is going to be a really dumb question, so I apologize for that. You're in 2 miles of ice. Is there land underneath all of this, or is this just a shelf of ice?
No, it's an excellent point, because at the North Pole, it's the opposite. The North Pole is just an ocean with a 20-foot thick layer of ice, whereas at the South Pole, you're over land, including mountains, and the mountains do poke through the ice in the so-called Transantarctic Mountain Range. But at the South Pole, where the ice is relatively at one of the thicker points, you're above the land. And down there on the land, there's mountains and rivers and solid ground. And you can see that along the coast and a few places where there's exposed land and then there's mountains around the perimeter.
That's fascinating. Because you talk in the book about the South Pole, they have to change the marker to where the South Pole is because of the shifting. So it's the ice shifting on the land?
That's right. That's right. This 2 mile thickness of ice is gradually flowing over the land. And so it calves off into icebergs around the perimeter of Antarctica, hundreds of miles away from the pole. But at the pole itself, the ice is flowing approximately 10 meters per year. And so they can measure it with GPS. And the station and everybody in it is actually moving this 10 meters per year. So relative to the station, you're moving the marker 10 meters per year. And they put up little flags showing the position of the previous markers. So you can see this trail of South Pole markers.
And why, I was reading the book, that why are there two separate markers for the South Pole? There's like a ceremonial South Pole, and then there's the actual South Pole. Why is that?
Excellent point. Well, there's actually six different South Poles. Like the most basic one is the spin axis of the Earth. The Earth is actually spinning about its axis, of course. And the exact point where this axis crosses the ground.
So that would basically be, if I'm looking at my globe, this is where the rod would come out that connects it to the other end of the whatever it's spinning on, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that's just called the spin axis. And relative to the surface, it actually wobbles around. It forms a series of nested circles, and which is near the so-called geographic pole, which is where your GPS will take you. The geographic pole is the convergence of all the lines of longitude.
Okay.
They come together at 1.90 degrees south, and that exact point is called the geographic pole.
So theoretically, that point, the geographic pole, should be our axis pole. Why is it not? Because the Earth actually wobbles? It doesn't spin perfectly?
That's right. That's right. If you were to look at the Earth from outer space, you would see, well, you wouldn't see it because it's so small, but the Earth does wobble around the axis. And so the geographic reference point has to be one point on the surface that doesn't move. And so that's how they define the geographic pole. And then there's also the so-called, there's the magnetic pole and there's the geomagnetic pole. And there's this pole of inaccessibility, which is the furthest point from land in the middle of Antarctica.
So the magnetic pole is not at the actual geographic South Pole?
That's right. That's right. It's actually 1,800 miles away from the South Pole.
Oh, wow.
And it's constantly moving as well. It's the same thing with the North Magnetic Pole. And this is where your compass will point. So your compass will point to the North and South Magnetic Poles. And even these points as well, they move around relative to the ground. And if you take a compass, it will actually point more and more vertically. And when you get to the magnetic poles, it's actually pointing straight down. So if you have a regular two-dimensional compass, it won't really read anything when you're near the poles because the magnetic field lines are vertical.
That's fascinating. A texter asked, can you ask the guest what degree parallel he's actually at? Because it's not the South Pole, I don't believe, is in 0 degrees. Thanks. Are you at like 0-0?
Well, that's right. Relative to the equator, which is 0 degrees latitude,
okay,
the North Pole is considered to be plus 90 latitude, and the South Pole is negative 90 degrees latitude. So at the exact South Pole, which is where the station is, you're at negative 90.000 degrees south latitude.
So the whole setup where the base is and the camp and where you worked, that was at the geographic South Pole, or just 100 feet off of it, right?
Well, 2 miles off of it. I mean, you're up in the air, really, being on the ice. But
But as far as the actual location, if you could drop down 2 miles, you'd be hovering sort of right over it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The South Pole marker was just out the window, and so you could easily walk to it. And they have what they call the ceremonial pole, which is near the geographic pole, maybe 100 feet away, where they have the South Pole marker with the sphere on the barbershop pole, and it's surrounded by a group of flags representing the countries of the original signatories to the Antarctic Treaty. And
okay, so let's talk about how you get there, because this is fascinating. People are texting with questions about this as well, because you said 2 mile sheet of ice and 12,000 feet in the air. So people are like, so how do you get up there? But it's actually you land on that ice, right? The final part of the trip is a plane that lands on skis that just lands on the basically a runway you guys have made on the ice, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the station is only accessible during the summer when planes can come and go. So it's kind of like an airport. And they're coming and going from McMurdo Station, which is on the coast of Antarctica, hundreds of miles away. And so all these aircraft that come in from McMurdo Station are bringing not only the people and supplies for the entire year, but also the fuel. So what they do is they defuel, so-called. They come to the pole, and they unload almost all the fuel except for what they need to get back. And that fuel is stored at the station in big tanks to supply the generators for electricity and heating. And then they fly back more or less empty.
Why do you need so much fuel? Because I guess so there's basically 6 months of light and 6 months of darkness at the pole, correct?
That's right. So one day lasts for 6 months, and during that time you've got 24/7, and then the Earth, let's think of it this way, the sun remains at a constant elevation in the sky during any 24-hour period,
mm-hmm.
and it just orbits from left to right across the sky, moving sideways.
Right.
And then at night, everything is dark for 24/7 for 6 months, so you don't see the sun for 6 months.
And it's got to be sort of degrees of that, right? Sort of like our dusk and our dawn. I imagine that during the 6 months of light, there's, say, 2 months in the middle where the sun is always at its highest, and then 2 months where it's sort of, you know, it's visible the whole time, but not right above you, and 2 months where it's at the other side.
I imagine
during the 6 months of darkness, the 2 months in the middle have to be the absolute darkest, and then towards the edges, you get a little more dusk and dawny type light, right?
Yep, exactly. So the sunset lasts for maybe 1 or 2 weeks. And even at the exact point of sunset, when the sun is just coming below the horizon, you have this green flash phenomena where you have the sun splitting into all different kinds of colors. It's really a spectacular phenomena that you can see at regular latitudes as well, but it only lasts for a second at most.
About how many people work at the South Pole Station, or are there doing experience? How many people are there all together at any one time?
Yeah. Well, it's basically divided into two separate seasons. This summer is when you've got 200 people, so it's a bustling place with airplanes coming and going and all kinds of people setting up their experiments and mm-hmm. coming and going. Whereas in the winter, there's only 50 people or so on the station.
Oh, wow.
And so it's a totally different ambience, because then it's just enough staff to keep the place going as well as to keep the experiments going.
And so in the summertime, you see they're storing up the fuel every time the plane comes in, unloads as much fuel as it can. You must have massive storage tanks all around the place then.
And well, that's right. That's right.
But in the summer, I imagine most of what you could do, I would think, would be on solar panels with the sun out all the time, right? It's just in the winter, there's going to be no solar energy, so you have to use fuel the whole time.
Yeah, there's no solar power there, because even though it theoretically would be a good place for solar panels because the sun is always up.
Yeah.
But the elevation of the sun is relatively low. It never gets higher than 23 degrees in the sky. Because if you think of a globe and the sun, and you're standing on the very bottom of the earth,
mm-hmm.
the sun is more or less out to your side. It's never really up in the sky. So it's not too ideal for solar panels.
Really? So it just wouldn't give enough power because it's not high enough up in the sky?
Exactly, exactly. So we have these big tanks of fuel. They look like train cars,
mm-hmm.
and they're buried under the ice. And that supplies the generators, which supply electricity and heat and all the regular energy. And because the energy is coming from the fuel that's been brought by the planes, it's in kind of a scarce supply. You don't really want to waste it when they've gone to all that much trouble to bring it. And it takes 2 gallons of fuel to bring 1 gallon of fuel to the pole. And a typical light bulb would use up 50 gallons during the whole year.
Oh, wow. So I imagine it's all CFL, CFLs have been banned. I imagine you're on all the LED bulbs and things like that down there.
Yeah, energy has to be highly conserved. And, of course, water has to be highly conserved as well. And so they have to limit the amount of showers and really try and limit the amount of water we're using, because the source of water is a lake under the ice from melted ice. And
but is it hard to melt ice, or just, I mean, there's you say there's a shortage of water. There's truly an endless supply of water. You just have to convert the ice into water, and I imagine the energy that takes in using fuel is the problem.
Exactly, that's it. Because you're really perceptive here. You're capturing all the key features of the pole.
Well, there was a lot of
Rodwell, and it's under the ice. The source of the water is sitting 400 feet below the surface of the ice. So you're drinking water that's coming from ice that's hundreds of years old. So you're actually drinking water from ice that's from the medieval times, and they keep it melted by circulating warm water down into this well and then circulating it back up again.
Sort of like the heating systems you can get in homes here now, where they bury the pipes.
Geothermal heating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of like that. That's how you keep it going. Well, that's got to be really good tasting water, right? That's got to be some really fresh, pure water, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's right. And it's a unique way to derive the water. And then they also have ice melting equipment should that fail. Like, everything is, of course, backed up.
Oh, I would imagine if you're going to face 6 months of darkness, you've got a lot of backup systems in place. Dr. John Bird is on the phone with us. John, I got to take a quick break. We have to do the news. I have 8 million more questions for you. Can you hang on for a few minutes?
Right, yeah, it's fun discussing it.
We have to tell people how you got there and what a problem it was to get there in the first place, and explain. So you land at McMurdo, which you said was on the edge of Antarctica. So that's on actual land, right?
That's right. That's right. It's on the coast of Antarctica. There's a mountain there, and there's a volcano there, in fact, and it's accessible to the ships. So it's easy to supply a lot of the heavier equipment by ship to McMurdo, and then from there they'll fly to the pole.
And can they only fly to the pole? I mean, you could drive things there, but it's just not effective, right? It's just not cost effective because it'd be so difficult to do.
That's right. In fact, recently they've started what they call the South Pole Traverse. Is basically a road that they use to haul some of the equipment and fuel to the pole via a tractor from McMurdo. So it's a several weeks voyage overland, but it can be done. People walk to the pole regularly every year. There's two or three people that will walk to the pole from the coast.
I just read the part of the book where these two guys suddenly come in with parasails and stuff or whatever. They're like trying to traverse the whole continent. They've got sponsors and things like that, right? And they just skipped into the South Pole and then stayed with you guys for a day or two and then kept going. And they had some sort of parasailing equipment that if the wind was right, it would carry them and their equipment. But the winds didn't work out well for them. There was a long time where they had to just keep walking and lugging everything. And then at one point, they did 130 miles in one day because the winds were right and they just pushed them along.
Yeah, people have used the same method to traverse the Arctic as well, up to the North Pole from Russia and then over to Canada. And, of course, the main problem with these voyages is that it, even in the summer, the average temperature is negative 30. So you really have to be equipped for winter camping.
Yeah, you guys talk in the book about the Christmas celebrations, and you guys are outdoors playing croquet and doing stuff because it's only like 20, or it's only like 16 degrees below zero, and this is like the best time of the year. This is the one. There was one of your coworkers was sunbathing. He had on jogging shoes and a swimsuit, and he was out laying in the sun.
Right, right. Well, that's of course after being in the sauna for
right,
a while.
Right, that part helps.
Yeah, but that's right. There's lots of activities outdoors in the summer. People are playing croquet and golf and really just enjoying the scenery. It's extremely scenic there with the halos that are formed from this so-called diamond dust, which are like ice crystals.
Which is also have to be extremely blinding. Okay, let me take a quick break. Hold on 1 second, John. Let's take a quick break. Let's get the news headlines from Roger and then more to talk about life at the South Pole. One Day, One Night, Portraits of the South Pole is the book. It's a New York Book Festival Award winner. Dr. John Bird and Jennifer McCollum are the co-authors. John is on the phone with us. He'll hang out after the news and answer more questions about a year in the life at the South Pole. All right, quick break in the news, 720 WGN. Thank you, Roger Badish. Mampu Bala here with you on 720 WGN, continuing our conversation with Dr. John Bird, who along with his wife Jennifer McCollum wrote One Day, One Night, Portraits of the South Pole. They weren't there for just a day and a night, but solarly, I don't know how you describe it, it was one day and one night because the South Pole has 6 months of daylight and 6 months of darkness, and I haven't gotten to the darkness yet, and I'm already fascinated by this thing. I don't know how they survived that. John, so let's jump back real quick. Thank you very much for hanging on the phone with us. Let's jump back real quick to how you got there, because I was fascinated by this. We get Jennifer out there. She starts work. She gets used to the altitude. You're flying. So before McMurdo, where do you have to fly? McMurdo is the airbase on the edge of Antarctica that you have to get to first. And your where were you flying from to get to there?
Oh, from Christchurch, New Zealand.
Okay, New Zealand. Christchurch, New Zealand.
There's a big center. It's called the Antarctica Center, and it's more of a logistical base, and it's a staging point for McMurdo. So at this Antarctic Center in Christchurch, they outfit everybody with their clothing, the so-called ECW, extreme cold weather gear, and all the equipment in logistics are staged from there.
So the ECW is like, basically it sounds like it was described as three layers of clothing. You have this inner layer, you have a middle layer, you have an outer layer that's the protective layer. When you throw it all on, is it about 10 or 15 pounds of clothing?
Well, that's right, because people in Chicago know what it's like on a winter's day, and of course there is quite a difference between, let's say, negative 10 and negative 100. And on the coldest days, in addition to all this gear, you need the chemical hand warmers in your mitts and in your boots just to keep warm enough.
Really? No matter how much you've layered up, if you don't have that stuff, you still are at danger of frostbite or at least extreme discomfort?
That's right, that's right. And, of course, you need to keep all skin covered up because the wind would give you frostbite for sure. And then, of course, in the summer, you'll need goggles because of the extreme brightness of the sun with the extra altitude and the reflection of all the snow.
Yeah, you'd snow blindness, it would burn your retinas probably staring at that stuff, right? It's got to be extremely bright.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, that happened to one of the guys. In fact, it was the station manager. We were out there setting up these so-called flag lines to join the outlying buildings with ropes, and he didn't have his goggles on that day, and he had some temporary blindness from that.
Wow, I could imagine. So you're flying from, it's Christchurch, New Zealand?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right.
Christchurch, New Zealand. And so every day, and it's not like, you know, we might think the tourist in us is like, oh, we'll get on a nice 747 maybe, first class seat. Sounds like you're basically on a military type cargo plane where you guys are sitting, like we've seen in movies, on these nets that are strung out along the side of it. You don't have some comfy seat for this trip, right?
Oh, right, right, right. Yeah, exactly. It's so compressed in the plane that they have to walk over your knees to get up and down. There's no real aisles, per se.
And cargo probably strapped down everywhere, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there's the washroom isn't exactly a private.
You described it as a funnel and a tube.
Yeah, exactly. So it is somewhat unique from that perspective. And plus, it's a long flight, too, because it's not that fast as a jet.
Right. And that this is where I was telling my family about this part. This is where everybody said, okay, we're not going to the South Pole. Tell everybody what happened, how this flight works, because it's not like there's a bunch of way stations in between. You get on this flight, and you get to a certain point where they have to decide. Explain what happens.
All right. It's called the point of no return, where... once you're beyond approximately halfway, you don't have enough fuel to go back. So you have to ask yourself, is the weather good enough at my landing point or not to land? And if it's not, which usually it wasn't when I was going there, we had to turn back and fly 4 hours back to Christchurch because the weather wasn't good enough at McMurdo.
Because there's no in between. It's not like you could land somewhere. Oh, well, the weather's not, we're going to divert you to Indianapolis. No, there's nothing else out there. Once you're 4 hours in, you come to a point where there's enough fuel to get all the way there or enough fuel to go home. Now we have to decide: is everything working
right,
fine?
Right.
Are we going to land 4 hours from now, or is the weather a little iffy? So the first time you're out there, you go back. It takes you about a week and a half. It sounded like to get out there, including another flight where you flew for 4 hours and then flew all the way back to Christchurch. Right.
Yeah, we did that several times. They're called boomerang flights, where you go out and you come back, because they want to try to get there if they can. So they'll take off if the weather looks marginal, but then if they realize it's not going to be good enough, they have to just come back. And you're out over the ocean between Christchurch and McMurdo.
Yeah. That must have been grueling to be on that. I just, most Americans, we don't love plane travel that much anymore as it is. This sounds like a really uncomfortable flight. An 8-hour flight is just traumatic. And to go out 4 hours and then start feeling the plane turn every time, you had to be like, oh, come on!
Right. And then finally, when you do get to McMurdo, you're still only halfway to the pole, because the South Pole is in the middle of Antarctica. So you still have another similar type flight to get to the pole itself.
How long is the flight from McMurdo to the pole?
Well, it's another several hours flying time by Herc. And, of course, there's no runways exactly in the normal sense, but they have these so-called skiways. So the Hercules is equipped with skis to land on the ice at the pole.
It's so crazy to think that you're landing on ice.
And then when they get there, it's so cold, they don't want to turn off the engines should anything happen to the plane. So they leave the engines going while they... defuel, as it's called, and unload and set up and take off again.
And so those pilots don't stay there very long. They might grab a bite to eat, let the plane do whatever it's got to do, people unload, and then they jump right back on and have to go back.
Yeah, that's right, because it's not a place you want to leave an airplane sitting with the engines off. Things start to freeze there.
All right, I have a couple of quick questions for you. A lot of questions coming in by text. 847 says, which government rules down there, and do you need to wear oxygen masks in the winter?
Okay, well, yeah, these are good questions. The point about who owns it is an interesting one, because there are a lot of countries that claim segments of Antarctica as pie slices, if you look at it on a map. But, of course, nobody actually owns Antarctica at all. And the South Pole Station, which is run by the United States, it's not owned by anybody, really. Nobody can own the ice there. But because it's an American base, they operate the airport, and the only people that work there are Americans, except for a few people they'll invite to come and help with the experiment. So they do have a number of international collaborators, but most of the people there that work are Americans. And for the people that endeavor to actually walk to the pole, they are actually welcomed by the station. And it's fun having visitors. Of course, there's not many. But
do you need a passport to go to Antarctica? I mean, is there a government in Antarctica, or is it just run mostly by Americans?
Well, the passports are needed in Christchurch.
Sure.
And after that, you're considered more or less in the U.S. as soon as you're at the U.S. base, and there's no infrastructure to keep track of passports at the pole. It's just a tiny base.
What about at McMurdo? Is that just an airport run by Americans as well?
Yeah, it's the same story. There's another American station, Palmer Station, so Palmer, McMurdo, and the pole are the American stations. And then there are a number of countries that maintain bases around the perimeter of Antarctica, and then there's a Russian station also within Antarctica, Vostok Station, and then there's a Concordia, which is a British station that's also in the interior of Antarctica. And regarding the oxygen, it's a good point that because you're 12,000 feet, you can adapt, and so there's no need for oxygen masks. But you do have to acclimatize.
Yes, which Jennifer had difficulty doing in her first couple of weeks. It's fascinating at the beginning of the book. 407 text, do you have flushable toilets there?
Well, it's a good point because there is a limited amount of water. But yeah, the toilets are set up as a regular toilet in the main station. But of course, at the outlying stations, there are no toilets. They have a, what do they call it? It's a bag type system. It's more or less like what you'd find at a campsite. Mm-hmm. Because there's no plumbing at these outlying facilities.
Well, you can't even, I imagine you can't do a composting toilet because the weather is not conducive for compost or anything to grow in the cold, right? I mean, it's...
That's right. What happens to the water is it ends up in one of the previously used wells. So after the water well's been used for a few years, then it serves as a kind of a sewer, you could say.
And waste and, goes in there?
Yeah. And then it's just sealed into the ice. And then so after millions of years, it's going to float to the coast and end up in the ocean.
And somebody will be like, hey, what the hell is this? So at the actual base at the South Pole, the toilets are flushable. They're comparable to being in America?
That's right. In the station itself. And then once you're at any of these outlying facilities, there's a few that are a couple hundred meters from the station. There's a what they call the clean air sector, where they have a atmospheric research observatory, and then there's the so-called dark sector, where they run the radio telescopes. That's another outlying facility. And so there's a number of people that walk to work each day along these flag lines.
You write a lot in the book, or you and Jennifer both talk about fire being such a safety hazard. The biggest concern, it seems like, at the South Pole is fire. Why is that? Because I imagine any effort to put out a fire, if it's not inside, well, if you run anything inside, it's a big issue, but I imagine it's so hard to fight fire in the freezing temperatures?
Well, and just the fact that there's no firefighters, except for the people that are there trained on the fire teams, and also if something were to burn down, it would be a life-threatening situation because we depend on the buildings for survival.
Yeah,
you could never. It's not like in a normal city where okay, your house burns down, well, you can go next door or anywhere else. But here, if your house burns down, then you have no survival equipment except for our emergency supplies, and then we have one of the buildings is set up as a emergency fire shelter, and there's all kinds of emergency equipment that we could sure call upon. But we train a certain number of people in firefighting, and we have drills every so many weeks, and we have trauma team drills as well for medical emergencies. So the normal infrastructure for fire has to be done by ourselves.
By the way, 847 text, a gentleman named Paul, who's a listener, texted me a photo of a patch he got from going to the pole in 1961. It says South Pole 300 degree club, minus 100 and then 200 degrees. It's a patch that he has. So he was there in 1961. I can't imagine how primitive it was back then, considering how tough it is to live there right now.
South Pole, or the 300 Club patch is what you receive for running outside when the temperature gets to negative 100 Fahrenheit. And it's the so-called 300 Club, where you heat up the sauna up to 200 degrees Fahrenheit, and then you see if you can survive in there, and then when you can't stand it any longer, you run outside with no clothes on, of course, except for boots. You touch the South Pole marker when it's negative 100, and then see if you can run back inside.
Jeez. How far does it take to run that?
Oh, it's maybe 100 meters or something like that. It's just a minute or two, but at negative 100, you tend to cool off rather quickly.
I imagine, and I would worry if you're coming out of a sauna, that means there's perspiration. I'd hesitate to ask where the icicles are hanging from.
That's a good point. So you really want to get back in the sauna as soon as you can.
I'll bet you do. If somebody tricks you and locks the door on you, you're really ticked off on that one. Don't pull that prank. All right, a couple more questions because we're running out of time. I haven't even gotten into the experiments that you guys did. And I haven't even read yet where you guys get to the winter part. So a couple things real quick. One is I teased earlier that we would have you talk about, because you guys write about the ice samples and what they find out in the cores, and that they can see from the cores what was in the atmosphere and what was going on. They have radiation from the nuclear testing. They have radiation, they go back so far down the ice, and here's radiation from nuclear testing in the 60s. Here's radiation up higher, closer to the surface after Chernobyl. They figured out why the Vikings stopped traveling so much by ship, because in 1400, looking far down these ice cores, there was a lot more sodium in the water. And so can you explain to me what that means for the Vikings?
Yeah. In the Vikings, during the stormy weather, it was too stormy to travel. And with the strong winds, it kicked up a lot of salt from the oceans into the air. And then whatever's in the air ends up
in the ice,
landing on the ice, forming a layer over Antarctica. And each year, this diamond dust, which is ice crystals, it's kind of like a type of snow, it piles on top of Antarctica, and it piles onto the previous year of snow. And it compresses it into yearly layers of ice, like it's like tree rings. And so preserved in the ice are tiny bubbles of ancient air. And because the ice builds up year after year, and it's so thick that you can go back almost the oldest one is over 1 million years old. So you can go back hundreds of thousands of years by drilling down into the ice and removing these so-called ice cores, and it's like an ancient library. And it's showing us the composition and the temperature of the air back hundreds of thousands of years ago. And we've been able to use this to correlate the carbon dioxide concentration in the air with the temperatures. And that's a way of substantiating the idea that carbon dioxide causes global warming.
It's amazing. It's amazing what you can find out from being there. There were all sorts of experiments going on. You were working on something with lasers, and I haven't gotten enough into the book to figure out what you guys were doing. What was the synopsis of what the experiment was you were helping work on?
My experiment was to study the upper atmosphere, which includes the phenomena like the ozone hole and the aurora. And we were studying it by sending laser beams up into the sky, and you look at the reflection, and the reflection gives you a profile of the density and the temperature of the air all the way up to 100 kilometers altitude.
So was that a winter experiment, or were you doing that when the sun was out as well?
Well, it can be done in summer and winter, but in the winter you're getting a stronger signal because the sky is dark. And so you can see higher up into the atmosphere, and you can look at the effects of the meteors, which ablate in the upper atmosphere, leaving a layer of iron up there. And it blows around with the aurora. And you can, by studying the temperatures at the North Pole and the South Pole, you can see how global warming is influencing the Earth. And it can give some insight into even what's causing the extreme weather that we're seeing nowadays.
When it's winter time, how often and how much of an aurora borealis northern lights do you see?
Well, at the South Pole, it's a daily event because you're living right underneath it. Because the aurora itself forms an oval that's centered around the geomagnetic pole. And because the Earth rotates under this auroral oval, that it's called, that forms around the geomagnetic pole,
mm-hmm.
the South Pole goes directly underneath the aurora every day. So it's constantly up there.
So when it was the winter, you saw it every moment of every single day or for a certain amount of time every single day?
Well, it would come and go during the day because the geomagnetic pole is oriented relative to the sun. And because the Earth is tilted and it rotates, the pole would go under the auroral oval twice per day. And so you'd see the aurora coming and going every day.
Have
you ever seen the aurora?
I've never have, and it's one of my lifelong dreams, and I always thought I'd go north to Alaska or somewhere to try to do that, but the South Pole sounds like it's the better place to go. Tougher,
well, Alaska is just as good. You can see it as well as anywhere in Alaska or Iceland or up north. Although at the pole we have the advantage of generally clear skies and dark skies all the time.
Yeah.
You see it all the time.
It must have been amazing and beautiful.
That's right. That's right. And when you can see it all the time, you get some really spectacular displays with all the different colors.
Mm.
And for me, it was a great opportunity because it was actually my job to go there and just watch the aurora every day.
Somebody asked, what was the highest temperature? What was the lowest temperature while you were there?
The lowest temperature was just under negative 100 Fahrenheit, which is when we had the 300 Club. And the warmest it ever gets is around negative 25 degrees.
Mm.
And the winter average would be maybe minus 60.
And that's just temperature. What about when there would be wind? Do they calculate wind chill?
Well, you could calculate the wind chill, of course, and it can get extremely windy there too. So you're way below negative 100 F.
Mm.
And on those days, you really have to dress for it. And when you're walking between buildings, they're actually connected by ropes. These are called a flag line. That's got bamboo poles every so many meters with flags on it, and it's connected by ropes. So that way you're not going to wander off.
Yeah, because if you wander off too long, you're frozen and just left. You'd freeze up and die probably relatively quickly, I imagine, correct?
Well, we carry radios as well. So, and then people are aware of where you're going, coming and going when it's that cold out.
I can't imagine. So I still have a lot more of the book to get through. I'd love to have you on the show again down the road, if you don't mind.
That'd be fine, yeah.
I do have to ask you, though, it's a terrible question to ask, but I can't imagine a life at the South Pole for a year and what that does to a marriage. I imagine it either makes you bond even better or tears you apart. Are you and Jennifer, you'd mentioned to me you have daughters, and I don't think you do when this book starts. Are you and Jennifer still together?
Well, we're actually not together, but it's not because of the pole. And we were together for several years following the pole, and that's why we have our two daughters, mm-hmm. so-called baby boom after the pole. There were a number of couples that got together after their Antarctica tours that all have kids. So there's a number of kids all out there roughly the same age. And but yeah, it is a good place for bonding because you really do need the friendship and companionship of somebody to keep sane down there.
I would imagine. And somebody was asking me today, you talk about the parties and everything like that on Friday nights. They made slushies because they have the world's purest snow. Drinking has to be an issue down there, I would imagine, especially during the winter months, because depression itself, it has to be tough to, and I know that you went through a lot of psychological testing. You talk about Jennifer going through a lot of testing with Raytheon before they hired her, but it's got to be very difficult. Is drinking an issue, or are people pretty good about making sure there's counseling and conversation to try to get through that winter?
Well, it's a good point. And unfortunately, there's not really the support that they need because there were a number of drinking problems. Like one guy actually had such a drinking problem, he ended up asleep outside, and fortunately somebody found him right away. Otherwise, that would have been disastrous.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can read more about it in the book. You'll see that and even more so at McMurdo, drinking can be an issue. So it's something that really needs to be addressed.
I would imagine. I would imagine it's very tough. You know, we read about it when we read about Alaska and life up there. That can be very tough. And I imagine at the South Pole, it's even more pronounced because it's such a dramatic winter and so claustrophobic, I imagine, at times as well.
Right. And any kind of medical issue can turn into a life-threatening problem. So anytime you fall or get hurt, you know, it could be a potential issue because there's really no hospital except for this one little room called Biomed, which serves as the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and that's why they make sure you're in pretty good health before you go, to try to avoid anything serious happening while you're down there. Dr. John Bird, who along with Jennifer McCollum wrote One Day, One Night, Portraits of the South Pole. It is fascinating. I'm loving it. I'll keep reading it. John, we'll have you on again if you're willing to come back.
Yeah, that'd be fun for sure. So thanks a lot, and I really appreciate your insight and ability to find the key issues and the most amusing points.
And there's so much more there. I can't even believe it. We will talk again. Thank you so much. I'm late for the news.